It's the NPR News Update for a Wednesday, June 18th. I'm Phil Picardi. Today on the podcast, rain and more rain messes with the economy. The director of the FBI lauds Minnesota anti-radicalization efforts. Members of Congress are concerned about Medtronic's move. And how do you study for college when you don't have a roof over your head? First, it's hard to stay dry without a roof over your head these days. More rain expected this week will add to already drenched soils and brimming lakes in much of Minnesota. As the state surveys the damage in parts of northern and southern Minnesota, some businesses are looking at slimmer margins and fewer customers. For others, however, it's a different story, as Peter Cox reports.
Jennifer Gilo and her husband own the Sandy Point Lodge on Lake Cabotogama, south of International Falls. It's been a tough open to the summer season. Gilo says their docks are underwater, their main lodge, restaurant, and bar are sandbagged, and water surrounds their largest rental cottage.
We're figuring at some point it will back off and we will catch our breath. We're just, at the moment, done trying to guess when that's going to happen.
Gilo doesn't yet know how much it will cost to repair docks and buildings. She expects resorts that depend on a full summer tourist season are going to be hit hard.
People are going to be stretched very thin to come up with the funds that they need to put things back together.
St. Louis County says there are between 10,000 and 15,000 sandbags in place around properties at Cabotogama and lakes nearby. Across the state, officials are just beginning to gauge the amount of damage to roads, bridges, and other infrastructure.
When you look at how many days in a row we have had damage from this whole storm system, and it's not done yet, we may exceed that $7.3 million and actually qualify to request a presidential declaration.
That's Minnesota's Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, Chris Idy. The federal disaster declaration can trigger funds to repair public infrastructure that local governments would have to pay to fix. Businesses have fewer options. Beyond private insurance, there's the Minnesota Investment Fund, which has flood recovery financing. After flooding in the northeast part of the state in 2012, qualified businesses were able to take out interest-free loans to repair damage. In Laverne, nearly 8 inches of rain have fallen since Friday. Just south of town, Rock County Implement store manager Dan Block described his shop's display lawn, which had more than 4 feet of standing water earlier in the week. The John Deere dealer has had some machines sitting in water, but Block's bigger worry is how much damage his customers have had.
We're talking some major destruction in the hail. I got customers that farm 5,000 and maybe have 600 left. So is it going to hurt? Yeah, absolutely. First thing they're not going to buy is equipment, obviously. We'll be affected, but we'll go on.
Laverne Mayor Paul Bostian says stormwater carried corn stalks and hay now block sewers and culverts. Many houses in town were flooded.
Even on the high ground, we had housing that was flooded upwards of 2 to 3 feet in the water, some 5 feet in the basement.
For those in Laverne and so many others who have had wet basements and worse this year, there are businesses to deal with that problem. Dwight Grutzmacher and his wife sell and install sump pumps. They run Northern States Basement Systems in Duluth. This spring, Dwight Grutzmacher was about to start a second business, but demand for sump pumps was so high, he had to put the launch on hold.
You know, one man's bad is another man's good, and it's definitely good for us. We already have as much business on the books right now that we did all of last year.
Even Sandy Point Lodge owner Jennifer Gilo has found some good in the lousy weather.
I've lost count of how many of our guests have spent time filling sandbags and helping us. They've just stepped right in and helped. We didn't ask. We just set to work, and our guests just walk over and pitch in and start to help. It's a bad situation water-wise, but it's a good situation as far as knowing the support that you have.
Governor Mark Dayton has visited areas affected in northern Minnesota. He'll tour the southwest part of the state Friday. Peter Cox, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Lots of farm fields have turned to ponds in southern Minnesota. Since last weekend, some parts of the region have had nearly a foot of rain. Flooded fields, though, still may produce a crop if the water drains away quickly. Mark Stile reports.
The hardest hit portions of southwest Minnesota are dotted with areas of standing water left by the downpours. Rock County farmer Lyle Rolag says he's received about 9 inches of rain since the weekend.
We had a constant rain all day Saturday, and by Sunday morning we had 5.8 inches. Then yesterday evening we ended up with about 3 inches of more rain.
The deluge put about 25 acres of his corn and soybeans underwater, and it nearly cost him some cattle that were in a pasture when the storms hit last weekend.
That pasture happened to have a creek that went through it, and that was well out of its banks.
The cattle ended up standing in 4 feet of water, but luckily the current washed out the fence that penned them in. When that happened, some 64 cows and calves were able to swim to safety. Rolag says the heavy rains eroded soil from his fields and others in the region, sometimes leaving gullies where the rushing water carved into the land. Hail also damaged crops in southwest Minnesota. Michael Wagner farms near the town of Rushmore. He says the storms harmed crops in a roughly 15-mile stretch of Nobles County near Worthington.
There's hail damage from just maybe some stripping of the leaves on the corn to complete destruction.
Wagner says farmers will be watching the weather over the next week, hoping for drier conditions. If that happens, he says he's planning to replant some soybean fields next week. But he says there's nothing he can do for his damaged corn. It's too late to replant. But there may be hope for some of those flooded fields. University of Minnesota Extension agronomist Jeff Coulter says it all depends on how fast the water goes down.
If that water is able to recede, within a day or two, the corn should start to regrow. Within about 3 to 5 days, we should see some new leaves coming out of the plant.
But he says if the water stays longer than that, the corn plant will die. Weather forecasts are calling for continued chances of rain this week, but then it may dry out some. Coulter says while southwest Minnesota was the hardest hit, other parts of southern Minnesota also experienced heavy rains. The downpours over the last few days brought with them more than just flooding rains and damaged crops in the southwest part of the state. Farmer Lyle Rolag says they also delivered a large dose of irony.
We couldn't seem to buy a rain, and now we can't seem to shut it off.
A month ago, Rolag's land in Rock County had drought conditions. Since then, he's seen too much rain.
We've had probably 12 to 15 inches since Memorial Day. Nature can be fickle.
That fickleness is something southwest Minnesota farmers have come to expect. In both 2012 and last year, heavy spring rains were followed by drought conditions that began in July and extended into the fall harvest. Although crops suffered, they generally did better than expected. One reason for that outcome was because the spring downpour stocked the soil with enough moisture to help crops through the dry weather. So far, this year seems to be repeating that pattern.
Mark Stile there in Worthington. The head of the FBI says he wakes up every morning worrying about the 100 or so Americans who have traveled to Syria to fight with radical groups there. It's also a pressing concern for the Twin Cities, where federal authorities are investigating who or what may have motivated a handful of young men to try to wage a holy war against the Syrian government. FBI Director James Comey says if left unchecked, the problems in Syria could spill over here. Laura Ewan has more.
9 months into the job, Comey paid a visit to the Minneapolis field office for the first time to, as he put it, talk with his troops as well as with local law enforcement. It's part of his plan to visit all 56 divisions in the Bureau, and he's more than halfway to his goal.
Good afternoon, everybody.
Comey also met Twin Cities reporters in the cavernous lobby of the FBI's offices in Brooklyn Center. Flanked by a couple dozen law enforcement officials from the metro, Comey's 6'8" figure loomed nearly a head taller than many of his peers. Comey says the fear that corners him every day is whether the jihadist unrest in Syria could ever lead to an attack in the U.S. down the road.
There are thousands of people from all over the world, including from all parts of the United States, who are traveling to Syria, learning the worst kinds of techniques and tactics, and making the worst kinds of relationships. At some point, there will be a diaspora out of Syria, back to Western Europe, back to North America, bringing with it those skills, those relationships. And we have to be very, very careful to make sure that we anticipate what the future might be if we're not careful.
Comey declined to say whether the FBI had any evidence suggesting that the Syrian extremists were plotting attacks on U.S. soil. But he did emphasize that the enlistment of American recruits wasn't confined to Minneapolis or any other city.
This traveler problem is not a New York thing. It's not a Washington thing, it's not an L.A. thing, it's an everywhere thing.
A spokesman for the Minneapolis FBI says new information suggests the number of travelers to Syria from the Twin Cities is smaller than the Bureau's earlier estimate of 10 to 15. The spokesman characterized the figure as a handful, but declined to be more specific because of the ongoing investigation. Through Facebook, NPR News interviewed a Minnesota man who said he's fighting with the militant group ISIS. James Comey says the group is a major concern because it wants to wage a jihad around the world.
It's something we have to be very, very vigilant on, and everybody standing here is focused on that.
Comey singled out Minneapolis as a national model for its work in trying to prevent the radicalization of young, disaffected men, particularly in the Somali American community. Comey says the rest of the country can also learn from the Twin Cities how law enforcement is working across local, state, and federal levels. But he also spoke of the challenges. It's been 7 years since the FBI started investigating the travels of about 24 young Twin Cities men to the Horn of Africa to fight with a Somali terrorist group. As high profile as that case was, it didn't keep others in recent months from following radical Islamic ideology to Syria, where the men had no family or ethnic ties. Comey said yesterday it would have been difficult to prevent those most recent departures, and he says that's why the FBI's work with local authorities through its Joint Terrorism Task Force is crucial.
It is most likely that a sheriff's deputy or a police officer is going to see or hear about a traveler looking to go or a traveler returning, and we have to make sure we are connected closely to those people so we hear about that and respond to it.
Still, Comey noted that the roughly 100 Americans who have traveled to Syria to fight is a relatively small number. He says the FBI has hundreds of counterterrorism staff from all over the globe who are focused on the problem. Comey has been outspoken on other matters, including diversity within the FBI. As a white man from the Northeast, he says the FBI needs more people from other backgrounds, including those in the local Somali American community.
And we'll take any height. You don't have to be freakishly tall.
Right? Comey says the Bureau will do better when it begins to look less like him and more like the rest of America.
Laura Ewan on the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. Members of Minnesota's congressional delegation are expressing concerns about Twin Cities-based Medtronic's plans to relocate corporate headquarters to Ireland as part of a $43 billion acquisition of Covidien. Such a move could potentially have a big effect in lowering Medtronic's tax bill. As Brett Neely reports, the planned deal comes as lawmakers say they want to overhaul the U.S. tax system, but remain deadlocked on how to do it.
Members of Congress from both parties will tell you the tax code is a mess. And to the members of the Minnesota delegation, this Medtronic deal certainly makes that point. Republican Congressman Eric Paulson is the only member of the delegation who sits on the Tax Writing Ways and Means Committee.
We don't need, you know, more lawyers and accountants or compliance officers hired to have to do work, to have to go through the machinations of how should companies be taking advantage of different deductions.
Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar agrees.
We have a serious need for comprehensive tax reform.
The proposed Medtronic deal highlights one of the key problems with the current system. Medtronic has nearly $14 billion parked overseas. If it brought the money back to the U.S., it could be subject to the 35% corporate tax rate. But if Medtronic moves its headquarters to Ireland, the money would be subject to that country's 12.5% corporate rate. Taking advantage of the lower rate would free the company up to spend billions more in the U.S. Lawmakers have been talking about tax reform for years now, with little to show for it, says Stephen Rosenthal of the Tax Policy Center in Washington.
There's a lot of disagreement on what tax reform would look like.
So why doesn't Congress fix the problem? Rosenthal says the parties disagree on how to do it.
Republicans generally view tax reform as a way to cut taxes, and Democrats generally view tax reform as a way to shift the tax burden.
The U.S. taxes companies on their global income, whereas most other countries tax companies only on their domestic profits. So American companies have taken to stashing an estimated $2 trillion overseas, rather than bringing it back to the U.S., where the tax man would get a bite of it. Paulson and other Republicans argue we should be like the rest of the world and not tax global earnings.
I don't think we should be taking action to make overseas the worst place to do business or to operate. I think we should be taking action to make the United States the best place to do business.
Some question whether the tax bill is really all that bad or whether American companies are just acting greedy. Stephen Womhoff is the legislative director of Citizens for Tax Justice, a group that's been critical of corporate tax policies. While many point to the 35% corporate tax rate in the U.S., the highest in the world, as the reason for why all of that cash is parked offshore, Womhoff notes that the real rate is nowhere near that high.
They get to subtract whatever they paid to foreign governments from their U.S. tax bill.
Klobuchar and fellow Democratic Senator Al Franken are co-sponsors of a newly introduced bill that would prevent American companies from merging with a foreign firm and reincorporating overseas to reduce their tax bill. Franken and Democrats argue that the companies are avoiding their obligations to the United States. Franken says if the companies don't pay up somehow, then the country will either have to make do with poorer public services or higher taxes on ordinary Americans.
In the end, it's all of us who pay for it.
For Democrats and Republicans alike, the Medtronic merger adds an urgency to getting tax reform done, says Klobuchar.
We're going to see more of these messed up situations if we don't start to think creatively about how to bring that money back.
One proposal that Klobuchar supports is to temporarily lower the rate if companies bring their overseas cash home and invest it. But Franken and some Democrats worry that such a tax holiday will only encourage companies to leave more money overseas in the future in the hopes of future tax holidays. Womhoff, who opposes such a deal, says getting Congress to act on almost any issue these days is a stretch.
Congress is a problem, you know, and Congress needs to pass a tax reform. Right now, I don't know if Congress can even name a post office at this point.
That means more companies are likely to follow Medtronic's path until Congress is finally able to act.
Brett Neely in Washington, D.C. Orono businessman Scott Unner is ahead in the fundraising race among Republicans to challenge Governor Mark Dayton in the general election. Catherine Richard reports.
2 months out from the August primary, Unner has a campaign cash edge over three other Republicans who want to unseat Dayton. Unner has raised more than $550,000 since the start of the year, but more than half of that has come from his own pocket. Meanwhile, Jeff Johnson, who won the GOP endorsement last month, has raised a fourth of that since January. The latest round of fundraising reports give an early glimpse into how Unner, Johnson, and two other Republican candidates are positioned financially in what's expected to be a heated primary battle. But money raised is only one measure of a candidate's fundraising success. What also matters is how much money they have in the bank. And in that regard, Dayton is far ahead of his potential challengers with more than $700,000 in cash and no costly primary challenge on the horizon. Catherine Richert, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Leaders in the waste and recycling industries joined state officials yesterday to find ways to prevent more materials from ending up in landfills. Here's Elizabeth Dunbar.
Minnesota's recycling rate has been fairly stagnant in recent years, and a Minnesota Pollution Control Agency study showed we're throwing away about 1 million tons of recyclable material each year. The MPCA also must later deal with landfills that are leaking contaminants into groundwater. Commissioner John Link Stein says that prospect should motivate people to reduce the size of the waste stream.
We're not ever going to say this job is done, because the legacy that we inherited is going to be a full-time employer for our agency. I don't want that to be the case going forward.
Stein says tougher recycling goals for the Twin Cities Metro and new requirements for commercial recycling passed by the legislature this year will help cut down on the amount of waste reaching landfills. Elizabeth Dunbar, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Some 2,500 college students are homeless in Minnesota, struggling to find shelter each night even as they juggle homework, papers, and exams. They keep such a low profile, many campus officials aren't even aware of them. So this month, some Minnesota college administrators gathered at the U to figure out ways to help. Alex Friedrich has been talking with them, as well as some homeless students, and he joined Tom Cran last night.
So first, how much do we know about the homeless student population in the state?
Well, we've only got estimates, and I think advocates say those are most likely too small. I mean, the students have no homes, and they often don't say they're homeless, so they're kind of hard to track. A professor at the U who studies the matter told me the estimate of about 2,500 in the state. Now, that's a really small fraction of the more than, I think it's 450,000 college students in Minnesota.
And given that small fraction, why is the state devoting resources to this?
Well, Higher Education Commissioner Larry Pogemiller says if the state can help them succeed, it will pay dividends later on. He says the cost-benefit ratio of helping them graduate is better for the state than to just let them drop out.
So how do these students handle college when they have so many pressing, basic, other needs to deal with?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, many have grown up hearing the same message that other students do in school. You know, go to college, go to college. Now, I mean, you know, they could try to find work now, and some do work during their studies. You know, but they look around, and they see only dead-end, low-wage jobs, and they see college as a ticket out of this. Now, you know, they get into college often with the help of nonprofit organizations such as YouthLink in Minneapolis. I mean, they take care of the students' basic needs, you know, food, clothing, stuff like that. And they tell the students about their college options. You know, they help them fill out college applications, financial aid forms, you know, kind of help them navigate the system. Students also get a locker as well as a mailbox, you know, so they have a place to get all the usual college stuff that's sent home.
What's it like for students to actually be juggling all this? What are you hearing?
It sounds really stressful. I spoke with William Mende, who's 22, and you know, for a while he was studying at Minneapolis Community and Technical College. And he's slept on friends' couches and in homeless shelters. And the shelters are no place to study. I mean, he told me about dealing with noise and fights and bed bugs, stuff like that. And late one night in the winter, he arrived too late to get a place at the shelter. It was snowing and cold outside. So he spent the entire night riding around on light rail and the buses just to stay out of the cold. And he still had to finish a paper for class the next morning. So, you know, he said, oh, those kinds of conditions, you're just out of it. Doing your reading is tough. I mean, you're like a zombie. And that's why he dropped out after a few semesters. And unfortunately, it happens quite often. One estimate puts graduation rates among the homeless in the single digits. So anyway, Mr. Mende is trying to find some long-term work and housing so his life can stabilize. And he hopes to return to school someday.
So they're gathering to talk about this at the U, looking for solutions. What kinds of things are they talking about doing for students like this?
Well, you know, one idea they proposed was to build a shelter just for homeless young people so they can live in safer conditions. Another was to have special work study programs, you know, child care for single parents as well, even a host family program. Now, some states have been experimenting with stuff like tuition waivers or giving homeless students priority when it comes to getting into student dorms. These are at universities, of course. And some U.S. colleges have established, you know, food banks, or they've started centers where homeless students can find employment. Now, the campus that stands out as a model here is actually Minneapolis Community and Technical College, which actually has a lot of the homeless students living in the state. It helps them with food, counseling, and emergency housing. Commissioner Pogemiller told me that, you know, one idea he has is for the state to start a fund to provide homeless students with short-term emergency money. That might get them through some difficult periods.
Alex Friedrich, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You can read more by Alex on homeless students at nprnews.org.
Tom Cran is the host of All Things Considered on the radio. I'm Phil Picardi, NPR News, and on Twitter at PicardiMPR. I'll be back with Thursday news on tomorrow's NPR News Update.